Well, at a time when the world is acutely conscious of global economic choke points, we're joined now by Edward Fishman, Director of the Greenberg Center for Geoeconomic Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Eddie is the author of the book Choke Points, which comes out in Australia this month. The original US edition came out in early 2025, and it had the subtitle American Power in the Age of Economic Warfare. The subtitle of the Australian edition is How Economic Warfare is Changing the World. Eddie Fishman, welcome to Sunday Extra.
Thanks so much for having me on today.
There's a lot of discussion at the moment, Eddie, about the Strait of Hormuz, which is a physical choke point for a large amount of oil and fertilizer trade. Is the Strait of Hormuz also a choke point in the sense you use the term in the book?
So the Strait of Hormuz is certainly the most important geographic choke point in the world. You've got 20% of global oil flows going through that narrow waterway on an ordinary day. Of course, in the last week, it's been substantially less than that because of the war that's raging. You also have around 20% of global liquefied natural gas flows. Throughout history, these physical choke points, be they straits or mountain passes, have often served as really important arteries for economic warfare, mechanisms for economic warfare. What's novel about economic warfare today, and really what I cover in the book, is that in the wake of hyper-globalization, this period that started in the 1990s at the end of the Cold War, where the entire globe, from the US to China to Australia to Europe, adopted effectively the dollar as the currency for trade and finance, when they adopted transnational supply chains centered with innovation in Silicon Valley, with manufacturing in China, with raw materials coming from places like Australia. What we had was the invention of these invisible choke points, these parts of the global economy that had very similar functions to physical ones like the Strait of Hormuz, but didn't require military force to block them off. So while the Strait of Hormuz, the only way to shut that down is for the Iranians to threaten drone strikes and mines, so physical blockages of the Strait of Hormuz. When you think about a choke point like the dollar, which is involved in 90% of all foreign exchange transactions, all the U.S. president has to do is sign a document and he can cut off any bank, company, individual, or even entire country from the dollar. And so this sort of invention of a more nonviolent form of economic warfare, where you don't have to put troops in harm's way to cut off somebody's access to a key lifeline of the global economy, has fundamentally reshaped how economic warfare works over the past couple decades.
And indeed, that's opened up a whole new range of techniques for applying economic pressure. That's been a transformation that's followed from that. Could you give us an overview of some of the novel techniques of applying economic pressure that have been developed by the US or others?
Maybe the best way to illustrate this is to look back right before the age of economic warfare, which I really date to the beginning of the 21st century to the present. If you go back to the 1990s, the most canonical case of sanctions in the 90s was when the UN imposed an embargo on Saddam Hussein's Iraq. That was put in place in August of 1990, right after Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, and it stayed in place all the way up until 2003, when George W. Bush launched the second bigger invasion of Iraq. The primary goal of that embargo was to stop Iraq from selling oil on the global marketplace. The way that the UN went about that was through a multinational naval blockade. For that entire 13-year period, ships from over 20 countries, commanded by a U.S. naval admiral, inspected every single oil tanker that was coming out in and out of an Iraqi port. So this was economic warfare through military means, implemented by defense departments, not civilians at, you know, finance ministries and diplomatic ministries. When you sort of fast forward, you know, to the mid-aughts, when you think about the sanctions against Iran, when the U.S. sought to cut off Iran's oil sales to the rest of the world, it didn't deploy a single naval vessel to do so. All we did, and I was actually involved in implementing those sanctions at the State Department and Treasury, all we did was go to the major financial capitals of the world, like London and Singapore and Dubai and Frankfurt, and basically tell them that if they kept facilitating transactions for Iranian oil, we would cut off their access to the dollar. And we had similar conversations with refineries in places like China and India and Turkey that were buying oil from Iran. And so literally by manipulating the access that companies, that banks had to the dollar, and saying that you could only have access to the dollar if you comply with our sanctions against Iran, we were able to have an even bigger impact on Iran's oil sales in the 2010s than the Clinton administration and the first Bush administration had on Iraq in the 1990s. I want to stress that this is not just the United States that does this. Probably the most impactful use of these types of choke points in the last year was last year when China cut off U.S. and other countries' access to rare earth minerals in April of 2025. In the United States, within weeks of that ban, we had Ford shut down factories that were producing SUVs in the Midwest of the United States because they were so dependent on this critical input from China. So it is not just the United States that possesses choke points and that has weaponized them in recent years.
What percentage of the world's governments actually do have access to economic choke points then?
It's a great question. And the answer is not many, but more than you'd think. I would say the most important choke points in the global economy are still under the control of the United States. I'd say the most valuable of all is the dollar. I mentioned involved in 90% of foreign exchange transactions. I would say close runner-up would be artificial intelligence chips that are designed by primarily NVIDIA, which controls about 85% of the global market. But their closest competitors like AMD are also U.S. companies. So if you look across AI chips, effectively, the United States monopolizes that industry. China, their most important choke points, as you might imagine, come in supply chains and manufacturing industries. So rare earth minerals, China's refining around 90% of the global supply of rare earth minerals. In batteries and other clean technologies, they have similarly dominant market shares. Other choke points are a little bit more targeted, a little narrower, but they still are quite palpable. So if you look in Europe, ASML, which is a company in the Netherlands, produces 100% of the EUV machines, these lithography machines that you need to produce high-end semiconductors. So just like you need NVIDIA designs to produce a high-end semiconductor, you also need these machines coming from the Netherlands. So that's certainly a choke point that Europe controls. And then you could argue that even in the fabrication of chips, the vast majority of the fabrication capacity is in Taiwan, right? And this is why they talk about the Silicon Shield in Taiwan. You've got TSMC who's fabricating around 90% of the AI chips in the world. So it's quite interesting, even in just one industry like artificial intelligence and the chips that are used to train the large language models, you have different choke points that are in different countries. You've got a designing choke point in the US, you've got the manufacturing equipment choke point in the Netherlands, and then you actually have the fabrication choke point in Taiwan.
Eddie, as I mentioned, a year or so has gone by since the first edition of the book came out. What does it say about the use of economic sanctions? The two prominent targets of US sanctions, Venezuela and Iran, have experienced American military aggression in early 2026.
I'm often asked the question, well, do sanctions work? And sometimes I find that question be a bit unfair because as somebody who used to work at the Pentagon, I never heard anyone ask, does a bomb work? Well, obviously, a bomb works quite well to blow things up, but it doesn't always get you what you want. And I think the same is true of sanctions. When you scope sanctions to a narrowly targeted aim that might be ambitious, but isn't crazy ambitious, say, we're going to keep the Iranian regime in power, but we're going to constrain their access to nuclear technology. I think that's a very viable goal for sanctions to achieve. And in fact, sanctions did achieve that. Over the course of two administrations in the United States, one Republican, George W. Bush, one Democrat, Barack Obama, the U.S. had a unified strategy to use sanctions to constrain Iran's nuclear program. When Donald Trump came into the White House in 2017, he made a bet. And his bet was that if only we did more sanctions, we wouldn't have to settle just for a nuclear deal. We could actually push out the Iranian regime. We could impose so much economic pressure. He actually called it the maximum pressure strategy that he could overthrow the Iranian regime. Sanctions are a powerful tool, but they're not all powerful. And I don't know a single regime around the world that's willing to commit political suicide in exchange for sanctions relief. And so I think what we've seen is that both in the case of Venezuela and Iran, Trump chose a goal for sanctions, namely regime change, that was beyond the capacity of economic warfare to deliver. And instead of throwing up his hands and saying, well, we tried, sanctions didn't work, we have to maybe have a narrower objective for our policy against Venezuela or Iran, He said, well, sanctions didn't work. Let's keep our policy and ratchet up to the use of military force. And so for everyone who criticizes sanctions, and look, I will be the first to say that sanctions don't always work and they can cause a lot of untoward humanitarian consequences. Oftentimes, the alternative to sanctions is not peace. It's actually going up the escalation ladder to war itself.
In that context, you describe the sanctions against Russia following the invasion of Ukraine as both significant and disappointing. I wonder if you could unpack both sides of that phrase.
Yeah, this is a personal one for me because I was the first Russia and Europe sanctions lead at the State Department in 2014 when Russia initially invaded Ukraine and annexed Crimea. Almost all of us who were on that team look back and say we should have hit Russia a lot harder in 2014. The reason we were incremental, that the Obama administration didn't really go for the jugular, that kind of went up the escalation ladder sort of with a bit of caution, was because we had never sanctioned a country as big as Russia at the time. At the time, 2014, Russia was the eighth largest economy in the world, and they were actually bigger than every other economy under sanctions combined. There was real concern in the U.S. that if we just took out the Iran playbook and just copied and pasted it to Russia, you would send Russia into a colossal economic and financial crisis that would rapidly spill into Europe and then spill into the United States. In some ways, this was the first time when U.S. officials had to worry about direct blowback, that if we sanctioned them too hard, it could affect us. So I think the Obama administration was too cautious in retrospect. I think it should have been more aggressive back in 2014, 2015. And then if you zoom ahead to 2022, when Russia launches the even bigger invasion of Ukraine, the Biden administration had a pretty unique historical opportunity. They learned 5 months before this invasion happened that it was going to happen. And so they had a long time to prepare sanctions and to potentially use them as a deterrent, to try to change Putin's mind about the cost benefit of invading Ukraine. And Biden did his best, right? He came out and said that Russia would face the most severe sanctions that have ever been imposed if they invaded Ukraine. And Putin invaded Ukraine anyway. And I think it's fair to ask, well, maybe Putin was just hell-bent on Ukraine. Could sanctions have actually worked? Maybe we will never be able to get inside Putin's head. But what we do know for a fact is that Putin underestimated the sanctions that the West ultimately would deliver. And the way we know that is that within 48 hours of the invasion, the G7 imposed sanctions on the central bank of Russia. So they froze the big portion of Russia's sovereign assets sitting in banks in the U.S. and Europe. But if you think about it, had Russia assumed that the West was going to sanction its central bank, why would it have left $300 billion worth of its assets sitting in Belgium and France and the United States and the UK sitting there for us to freeze? Clearly, Putin did not see this coming. And so I think that in some ways, we should be proud of the fact that Western governments did rally around and impose substantial economic blow to Putin right at the beginning of this invasion. But by the same token, we should question, why were we not able to credibly signal deterrence to Putin before the invasion? And then I think after the invasion, why were we so cautious about sanctioning Russian oil sales, which overall have allowed Russia to stay afloat? Well, you know, I don't want to exaggerate. The Russian economy is limping along. The reason that they've been saved from a dramatic economic crisis is because they've continued to sell oil in effectively the same quantity that they did at the beginning of the war for the last 4 years.
We're speaking with Eddie Fishman, author of Choke Points, How Economic Warfare is Changing the World. And Eddie, I think everyone's very acutely aware of the favorite economic weapon of President Trump, the tariff. I wonder if you could tell us which countries you see as demonstrating the best response to the Trump administration's tariffs and why?
So I think if you look across the countries that have been hit by tariffs, and by the way, it's effectively everyone, I think you can really distill three countries that have done a very good job. And that is India, Brazil, and China. And if you look across their responses, there are actually three commonalities. It's resolve. They've done a very good job at rallying their people for defiance. So if you look at India, when Trump hit India with a 50% tariff in August, instead of India kind of rushing to the negotiating table, Prime Minister Modi made this sort of a cause for nationalism and said, we are not going to bend over, you know, and bow down to the United States. Instead of lowering prices to try to continue to sell into the U.S. market, Indian companies said, you know what, we're going to keep our prices the same. And effectively, Modi was able to show that he had political support for his policies, even if that meant they would suffer some near-term economic pain. Brazil, I think, is the best example of this. You know, the Brazilians also were hit by a 50% tariff because Trump was upset that the Brazilian justice system was prosecuting Bolsonaro, the former leader of Brazil, who had tried to overturn an election in 2022. Bolsonaro is a political ally of Trump. Trump retaliated by sanctioning the Supreme Court justice who was prosecuting Bolsonaro and imposing a 50% tariff on Brazil. So what did Brazil do? They showed that they could be resilient to these tariffs. They adapted. The beef exports and the coffee exports that they used to sell to the United States, they rerouted to the Middle East and Asia. And at the end of last year, Brazil's exports to the United States collapsed, but their overall exports had a record year because they'd so successfully adapted and rerouted to other markets. The third pillar, besides resolve and resilience, is retaliation. And China is the best example of this. When China was hit by a 145% tariff last spring, the Chinese not only responded with tariffs of their own, and they did impose, you know, over 120% tariffs on the United States, but critically, they responded asymmetrically. That's when they cut off America's access to rare earth minerals, when they forced American automotive companies to shutter factories, when they caused U.S. defense contractors to scurry around the globe looking for rare earths to produce the missile systems that the United States right now is relying on in its war in Iran. And I think what that did was it showed the United States that it's not just direct blowback. It's not just, you know, the impact of tariffs, our own tariffs on ourselves. Other countries might fight back. And I think if there's one Achilles heel of the United States when it comes to economic warfare, is that we've shown we have a very low pain tolerance. As soon as the stock market takes a little bit of a dip, and soon as oil prices start ticking up, this is when we get the acronym TACO, Trump always chickens out. And I think that the Chinese found that they can manipulate that. And I think other countries now are drawing similar lessons, which is why you saw the European Union actually come together to potentially impose this anti-coercion instrument a few months ago when Trump was threatening to annex Greenland. And I think that worked too to get Trump to back down.
When you were discussing the sanctions on Russia, you mentioned that that was done by the G7. And going all the way back to the Gulf War, it was a UN blockade of Iraq. Is US economic power wielded more effectively in combination with allies?
Oh, certainly. For a few reasons. I think even though the United States controls the most valuable choke points like the dollar, like advanced AI chips, like jet engines, certainly our power is amplified when we're working with allies and partners, not just, you know, the Europeans and the Canadians, but, you know, the Australians, the Japanese, really as many as you can get on board. And I think that was critical to the Russia sanctions. But I think there's an argument for multilateralism that goes beyond efficacy, because I think we also have to be honest that because the U.S. does control these choke points, it can impose substantial economic pain on other countries, even when the U.S. acts unilaterally. And that's a pretty uncomfortable fact for a lot of countries around the world, but it's true. I still think, though, even from a narrow self-interest lens, the U.S. should be imposing sanctions with allies. Why? When the U.S. imposes sanctions by itself, say we just cut off, you know, Russia by ourselves from the dollar, all of a sudden, Russia and other countries have a lot of good other currencies to hedge into. The euro, you know, the pound, the yen, you know, the Canadian dollar. These are all alternatives to the dollar if the U.S. is acting unilaterally. And so it basically adds a geopolitical risk premium on U.S. financial system, on U.S. technology. On the flip side, when the U.S. imposes sanctions with the issuers of all the other major reserve currencies, as we did on the Central Bank of Russia in February of 2022, what it does is it signals to the world that the dollar, the euro, the pound, the yen, all of these currencies have the same identical geopolitical risk attached to them. And so all of a sudden you say, okay, well then why would I ever invest in the euro or the yen or the pound when I could be in, you know, in the US, right? When I can have all the benefits of being invested in US markets, all the convenience of using the US dollar. So I think from the narrow self-interested standpoint, if you want to preserve the sources of American economic power and financial dominance, it's best to act with allies.
And finally, Eddie, and I'm just asking this for a friend who doesn't want to be named, how should a middle power, a nervous American ally deal with the Trump administration's use of tariffs?
So look, and this probably won't come as a surprise to Australians, because I think, they kind of get this, that in order to be respected, you have to be strong. And so showing that you're valuable, showing that You have a lot to add, I think is important. And that's part of the reason Australia has done a good job. You know, Australia does have a lot to add in terms of American economic and military strategy in the Indo-Pacific, for instance. Australia has a huge amount to add when you're trying to think about alternative supply chains for critical minerals, you know, and you're trying to break China's choke point over that sector. I do think that the resolve, resilience, retaliation framework applies to Australia. God forbid if you were to have a U.S. president threatening Australia with economic coercion. I don't think coming to Washington hat in hand is the best solution, but I'm not sure that that's would be what Australia would be bound to do in any case. The final point I'll make, though, and you know, it's a long flight from New York to Australia, so I haven't been there recently, but I've spent a lot of time in Canada, and I can tell you that the Canadians have similar concerns and have been quite nervous about what the future portends for the U.S.-Canadian relationship. And what I'll say fundamentally is that in the long-term perspective, I remain optimistic. And any Australian who comes and visits New York, any American who comes to Sydney, you feel a cultural affinity. You feel a common bond that goes beyond any individual political, any individual government that's in power at the moment. And so in the long term, I'm still very bullish on U.S.-Australian relations. I certainly hope that Australian officials don't have to spend too much time and effort thinking about how to defend themselves against American economic warfare. But look, I also understand why, given the events of the past year, that might be at the top of people's minds right now.
Eddie Fishman, thanks very much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
Yeah, my pleasure. Good to be here.
And Eddie is the author of Choke Points, How Economic Warfare is Changing the World, and director of the Greenberg Center for Geo-Economic Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.